be reality, not illusion or delusion that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And this evening we have with us Anita Dietman, and we're going to be talking about her book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell. A young Jewish girl discovers the Messiah, faithfulness in the midst of the Holocaust. And it's really a very, very touching story. We've had Anita on our afternoon program, but never on our evening program. So I wanted really to have you hear her story. And, of course, Anita, are you there?
Oh, yes, I am.
Thank you so very much for being with us and for staying up here a little late to...
That's okay.
to share your story with us. And so why don't I just sort of let you get started telling this story. It really begins, Anita is, it's 1939, so she is 12 years old. And it starts out, you know, where, of course, they're expecting they're going to be able to get out of Germany. They are expecting visas for her mother, for her sister, Hella, and for herself. And, of course, when the visas arrived from Great Britain in 1939, there's just one for her sister. And so her sister is going to escape to England. And, of course, they expect their visas are going to come in a week or so, but Hitler invades Poland, and suddenly they're trapped, and there's no way out. So you pick the story up really from there.
That's okay. How
the book begins, and then it goes back in time to her early life. So you pick up the story.
You want me to pick it up right there?
I want you to pick it up.
1939?
I want you to go back to the very beginning. And really, of course, how it was you came to know the Lord.
Okay, Hitler came to power in 1933, and I was about 5.5 years old. My mother came from a somewhat Jewish background, I mean, somewhat Orthodox Jewish background. However, when she was a young girl, she left the Jewish religion and joined the ranks of the intellectuals. My father was an atheist. He was a pure-blooded German. So as a result, my older sister and I had no Christian nurture whatsoever, but we were so comfortably wealthy. We lived in a nice district on the outskirts of a very large city, and we didn't know what we were missing. And I was, of course, very talented in dancing, and so I was taking lessons from a ballerina who in her younger years was very famous, and when she saw my talent, she thought that someday with her training I would be very famous. And she said, you know, among other things, what a ballerina enjoys is that people that really worship you. And I thought, wonderful. So I gave it my all. But I found out soon that God had a different idea for my life, because when Adolf Hitler came to power, the scene of my life began to change. Soon I felt like an outcast. See, Hitler had a grandiose idea to make Germany into a master race. He called them the Aryans. He would purify the nation from all undesirables, and at the top of the list were the Jewish people, and everybody had to register. And you had to list whether you were Aryan, which was called the German people, or a Jew. And of course I was a little both, but they put me on the undesirable side. At first I didn't notice too much of a change, but when I went to school, because the applications, or copies of the applications, were sent to the school, and then as soon as the teachers knew that I was one of the undesirables, trouble started. I was unfairly treated, often I was persecuted by my peers.
And, of course, children can be awfully, awfully cruel.
Well, actually...
A moment right there.
Yeah.
All right, you go ahead and tell the story. You were going to school and your children...
You mentioned that children are very cruel. Actually, they are, and it's the grown-ups that make them that way, because children by nature are in prejudice. And, but the parents had a powerful influence. And anyway, to make a long story short, I survived. Time marched on quickly, and pretty soon my father left us because he couldn't stand the pressure professionally and for certain other reasons. And so when he left us, that wonderful life of earthly splendor came to a sudden halt. And literally overnight, my mother, my older sister, and I were transferred into the most devastating poverty you can imagine. We had to leave our beautiful home, move into a tiny little one-room apartment, but at least it was clean. It was hard for my mother.
Now, has your father really left, at least in part, because your mother was Jewish and the Germans didn't approve of his being an Aryan being married to a Jew?
Yeah. So, it was... But then, you know, there was always my ballet, and I remember when my teacher asked me to perform, be one of the dancers in the gala performance. When my time came, I had been properly trained by her, and when the music started, I started to dance. And when I danced, I was in a world all of its own. Nothing outside could touch me, I thought. And when the music stopped, I was overwhelmed by the tremendous applause that I got from a large audience. And I knew then that that's the beautiful life my teacher had predicted for me. However, the next day, reality struck, and my mother found a newspaper, and she read from it to me, and I was about almost 7 years old then, and it stated that the dance was, you know, wonderfully performed by Anita Dittmann, far above her age level, but the German people no longer wanted to be entertained by a Jew, and due to our poverty, there was no money for ballet lessons, and I saw all my hopes and dreams crumbling into a thousand pieces, but soon after that, I found out that God had a very different idea for me. He didn't want me to be worshipped and glorified. He wanted me to live to worship and glorify Him. And that's why He permitted for my ballet to be destroyed, my dreams. And it was soon after that that my playmates that lived upstairs brought me to their church. And it was during that church service that Christ came into my life. I was so overwhelmed and happy, and I ran home, and this was now, you know, I was, as I said, in first grade, and I wanted to share that with my mother and my older sister, but they didn't want to hear about it. That to them, that was a childish fantasy. But time marched on.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Anita Dittmann. We're talking about her book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell, which incidentally we carry because we think it's a wonderful and very, very touching book. But Anita, of course, was unable to continue her ballet lessons, although she would have been a superb ballerina, but of course because she was Jewish and because of the poverty they lived in, she had to give up her ballet lessons. But she was taken to a church by some Christian friends. She gave her life to the Lord. And what were you, about 7 or 8 at the time?
I was about 7.
All right, so you pick up the story from there.
Yeah. Well, finally now we heard about the Gestapo, the SS. We saw men, women, and children marching in uniform down the streets, singing, waving the Nazi flags. Nazi flags were hanging out of every window. And life became very intense, very fearful, because the escalation, the persecution of the Jewish people was being escalated on a daily basis. Pretty soon we came to the year 1938, and this is the beginning of it. And I was very blessed to be able to go to a parochial high school, since high school started in fifth grade. And there I was treated like a human being. Neither my peers nor my teachers persecuted me. And during that year, we were introduced to a Lutheran pastor of an inner-city church who belonged to the confessional Christian movement that was very much persecuted by Hitler, just like the Jews. And he had a love for the Jewish people, and he reached out to us and to many others like us, and he invited us to come to church, he invited us to come to Bible study, and was that love that he displayed, and the fearlessness of really risking his life and the life of his family, that convinced my mother that was Christ. She saw it displayed through him, and my mother accepted Christ.
Nazis were actually, of course, persecuting any Christian who, anybody who helped the Jews. This was really almost a criminal offense. So the minister was really risking everything by befriending you and your mother, but he did it because he felt he was carrying out what God had commanded him to do.
Yes.
Go ahead.
And he also helped me to have a much deeper faith, to not just use the Lord as my best friend and my crutch, but to really know what it means to make him the Lord and Savior of my life. My sister never accepted Christ. She just pretended on the surface. Well, for one fine morning in church, it was now 1939, we had been evicted from a nice little flat at the outskirts of this big city that we lived in, and we had to move into the inner city Jewish ghetto. But we thank God nevertheless. And in that ghetto, there were four families sharing one apartment, each family residing in one room. We had to share rather small quarters, but we all managed. But what was the tough thing, this was already 1939. We had passed through the burning of the synagogues on the 8th of November. We had passed through the Kristallnacht and people being hauled away to concentration camps. So our pastor informed us at one moment that he had gotten in touch with an organization in Berlin that would help us to go to England. And he got the ball rolling, so to speak. And sure enough, in July of 1939, my sister's visa arrived, and we were told that the hours that were on the way, too, that they would come soon. It was the 31st of August when we escorted my sister to the railroad station where she began her journey. We consoled her, you know, she was very sad that we couldn't go with her, and we promised her that any day we would be there and be reunited with her, but that day never came for my mother and me, because the next day, on the 1st of September, all the borders were closed and patrolled, no traffic was allowed out of the country, and no foreign mail was allowed into the country, and with that, we were trapped in Hitler's hell. We never rejoined my sister. And to top it off, Hitler also closed all the parochial schools, and I found myself back in the prison walls of the German schools where I was very much under persecution. However, there were some nice teachers, and I also had a couple of friends that were very kind to me. At least I got an education, but that didn't last long either, because when I was 15 years old, the principal walked into my classroom, and he said, "Dittmann, pack up all your things. Meet me out in the hall," and he handed me a written statement from the local Gestapo telling me that due to my Jewish heritage, I was permanently suspended from school. And he added to it, he said, "Thank God that the German government is finally cleansing our school system of riffraff such as yourself." And about 2 months later, I was drafted into very, very heavy factory labor called forced labor, and my mother had already been working there. And I worked there with other people like myself. It was very hard work. But no matter how hard we worked, no matter how hungry we were, no matter how many bed bugs bit at night in the ghetto, but we just praised God that we were still relatively free.
Now, had your mother come to accept the Lord by this time?
Oh, yes. She did. She did in 1938. Yeah, when we met this pastor. Yes, she had accepted the Lord. And it was wonderful that we had something in common now, that she understood my love for Christ. And even though we worked hard, we still had Sunday morning. Sunday morning was like a refueling station for our souls. Our pastor gave us the strength. And he always said to us, and he'd say goodbye, he'd say, "Now, Hilda and Anita, I just wanted you to know, too, that even if death was the ultimate for either one of you, remember death is but the door to eternal life," and that gave us a lot of strength. I was between the ages of 16 and 17, right there in the middle, when on the 7th of January, 1944, the Gestapo knocked at the door, and we were wondering for whom it was again today. We had already lost so many friends and relatives that were literally hauled away like cattle to the slaughter, never to be heard of again. But that morning, they came for my mother. It was a very dark winter day, January 7th, 1944. She had to sign a statement that everything in that room that we occupied was her property, that was now the property of the state. They put red labels on everything, and I was informed that the next day the authorities would come and take everything to the Gestapo headquarters, and if I wanted anything, then I would have to buy it back at greatly inflated prices. The only thing I was allowed to keep was my bed, my clothes, and my very personal belongings. And my mother had just enough time before we parted to give me my father's home number. My father lived in a different city. He had long since remarried. And she said to me, she whispered to me, call him, he would help you. And he did come and help me, and I didn't lose everything. I didn't know at first where they had taken my mother, but when I found out that she was in Camp Theresienstadt in Czechoslovakia, an odd thing happened. They were allowed to receive food packages now and then. Well, I knew that on my measly salary in the factory, I didn't earn enough money. I just had enough money to buy food for myself and in transportation to and from the factory. But I realized that my mother had made many sacrifices in my life, and it was now time for me to reciprocate. And what I'm telling you now is not that I'm blowing my own trumpet, but I just merely did what needed to be done. I prayed to God. I said, Lord, I will be glad to give to my mother this almost all the food. I'll just keep a fraction, but I need a miracle from you. Sustain me, that I can continue. And he did. In 7 months that I was alone, I ate no more but a piece of bread in the morning, and I drank a cup of imitation coffee. Then I drank nothing but water, and I worked hard. And at night, I was lucky if I just had a bowl full of, well, some soup, of some watery soup, maybe no meat, nothing. And all through those 7 months, eating like this, and I was slender to begin with, I worked hard. I did not lose one single pound. The Lord protected me from all the epidemics around me, and I had energy enough to give away. And it was so rewarding when my mother would write a little card. This was all she was allowed to do. And she would mention all the items that she had received, letting me know that nothing had been stolen from it, because it was the known factor that the Nazi guards would often help themselves to these things.
Well, and because you were basically sending her loaves of bread and things of that sort.
Yeah, and the bread in Germany, I always say it's different from ours here. It's hard enough to sit on it without making a dent into it, and it's very nourishing and almost non-perishable. But one morning during those 7 months that I was alone, it was about 6 months that I'd been alone, I had a strange notion to go to the bake shop and get Zwieback, which is toast. And I shipped it off, and I couldn't understand why I was doing it, only to find out 10 days later that she had been stricken with dysentery and had literally knelt by her cot that she was sleeping on and prayed to God to convey to me that I would send her Zwieback because she could not eat the dark bread. And I thought, what a hotline to heaven that was. And I said, that hotline is still available to all of us if we just believe. She recovered from that, and I continued to send the dark bread. Well, now it was August 9th, 1944. I had been alone now for 7 months when I got a notification from the Gestapo to be in line the next day at the railroad station, that I'd be shipped off to another camp. And I had enough time with God's inspiration to go to the bake shop, get a loaf of dark bread, and make an indentation, a deep indentation there, put a note in there, sealed the label of the bread back on, and asked a friend of mine who didn't go to camp to send the bread to my mother, to let my mother know in a gentle way that I have to go away for a while, that I could not send her any food. And I prayed.
Hold that thought for just a
moment.
Go right ahead, Nita.
Yeah, and, you know, I prayed that the Lord would protect the bread from falling into the hands of a Nazi guard, because if they would have found the note, they would have killed my mother. And many, many months later, I found out that for the very first time, the bread had arrived totally covered with a thick layer of green mold. which protected the bread from falling into the hands of a Nazi guard. And yet my mother was so starved that she scraped off all the mold and kept slicing the bread, and this is how she found the note. And I said, isn't God wonderful, the miracles? I could spend 2 hours telling you about the miracles that he performed during this time. But my camp was composed of mostly half-breeds like myself, half-Jews, as they called us. Men and women, have a couple or three married couples. They weren't allowed to work to live together, but they worked together. The women were housed in a dirty old cow barn that had never been cleaned out. There were about 150 of us. The floor was covered with a thick layer of straw. We were each given 2 what they call horse blankets, gray blankets, and we could lie wherever we wanted to. Our toilet facility was an open ditch that had no walls, no protection, no privacy. And our washing facility were 450 yards with cold water faucet on the outside of the barn. So the authorities issued us little enamel pans that we had to share with 9 other people. The men lived in an old horse stable not too far from us under similar circumstances. We were awakened at 4 in the morning. Of course, this was August. It was hot. We were counted and recounted for an hour. Then we were given a piece of bread and a cup of that same brew that I mentioned before. And then we were loaded up with digging equipment, shovels, spades, and picks, and we were marched off. And when we came to our work area, we were told that we were going to now be digging ditches. Ditches that were about 7-8 feet deep, probably 15 feet wide, and I don't know how many kilometers long. They were supposed to be used as tank traps in case the Russians should ever decide to come into the country. We worked in the burning sun from about, early in the morning, probably anywhere from 8 to 10 hours. And then we marched home, and then we stood in line for our very watery soup. And there were 300 of us or so waiting in line. And then after we were done, we were given a piece of bread, and that had to last for the next morning. And unfortunately, when we'd wake up in the morning, the rats had come and helped themselves and left their little calling cards there. So we had to march and work on an empty stomach. It was hot, too. But praise God, nobody died from it. The ages were, I was 17, and there was one that was younger than I. Ages were from about 15, 16 to age 65. We worked hard, and the treatment was very cruel. But we thank God that we weren't in Auschwitz yet. Winter came, and things changed. However, one good thing was during digging ditches, even though we weren't allowed to talk to each other, some of us that were Christians couldn't keep quiet, and so we would witness to each other. And pretty soon we knew who the Christians were in the camp, and we would meet after work in the barn.
Hold that stuff right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Anita Dietman. We're telling her this, her story of trapped in Hitler's hell. And Anita, of course, was in Hitler's Germany. She's been taken now to a concentration camp. They're forced to do very hard work, and they don't know when they're going to be taken to Auschwitz and liquidated. But she and some of the other people there, they're Jewish, but they're Christians, so they're beginning to witness to one another. They find out that there is a small group of Christians in this concentration camp. And so you pick up the story there, Anita.
Yeah, and so at night after work, we would sit in the barn and read our scriptures and recite Bible verses, and we would pray for one another. Well, winter came, and we were moved to a different location. We were done digging ditches, and now we had to work in the forest, do heavy, heavy labor. I won't go into detail about the work we were doing, but it was very heavy labor, and of course we were fighting the winter elements. Our clothes was insufficient, and on top of our clothes we wore gray coveralls, which was our camp uniform, and food rations had gotten more scant. More people had come to the camp, and things were more and more difficult. The sanitation was poor. We contracted lice from each other. And we found out that now, as soon as our work was completed, we would be shipped to Auschwitz to be cremated. So no matter how many lice crawled on our heads, no matter how cold we were, no matter what, we just praised the Lord that we were yet still not in Auschwitz. One fine evening, very late, we were all ordered out of our quarters. We had to stand in line. It was a very dark, overcast night. Of course, there, since the blackouts, you know, nothing, now light shone from the farm buildings that were around us. And some people escaped that night through the forest that was near us. And I was almost among them. But a dear friend of mine kept my girlfriend and me from going along, and I thank him yet, because if he hadn't kept us from going, I wouldn't be here to tell you the story, because I found out after the war that the people that escaped that night were caught and were taken to my hometown into an apartment complex, and the bomb was dropped on it, and they all perished. Among them were many of my good friends. Well, the night that we were, that I just mentioned, we marched and marched and marched. I thought they were going to march us to death. Finally, they found a new campsite for us, and we did other heavy labor, different from what we had been doing, but it was just equally hard. Well, I had, my shoes had given out, and I was given a pair of shoes with wooden soles and rough tops, and there was no more sanitation. We couldn't wash our clothes or our bodies, and I was wearing woolen socks. Anyway, I rubbed a blister on my right heel, and it popped open. We didn't even have Band-Aids, and dirt got in and became infected, and I could see the infection worsening, but I was not even able to let myself wince or say anything or even limp. I had to really ask the Lord for self-control. Sometimes I would lean on a friend, because if the authorities would have known anything was wrong with me, you see, if you weren't fit to work, they either shot you on the spot or they tortured you to death. And even though I knew my ultimate destination would be Auschwitz, there was that hope that maybe, you know, I would stay alive. And I know a lot of people recovered and lived through Auschwitz. Well, it was about now the 10th of February, 1945. We had been in the camp now for over 6 months. And it was another cold day. We were marching home, and we saw the villagers running. There was total chaos all around us. People were running with their livestock, with their belongings piled high on wagons, pulled by horses. And we could hear roaring in the distance. We saw the sky on the horizon at night lighting up almost like a firework, and we didn't know what was happening. And so one of the villagers whispered to us, "The Russians are very near." That night, our women's camp was shut up tight. I mean, locked up completely. Nobody could escape. We didn't know what was happening. And through dirty, small windows, we saw that all night long, our guards would be surrounding our camp with bayonets and rifles over their shoulder. We didn't know what was going to happen to us. But we could literally feel the vibrations of the fighting that was coming nearer.
Now, that's fine, Will. We're going to just, we'll be back in just a moment with Anita.
Yes.
And certainly, this is the war is coming to an end. What about your leg? Is your leg still badly infected?
The leg doesn't bother me, but my foot.
All right, fine.
Was not a problem.
When did they take you to the hospital, do you remember?
When? It was after I escaped from the camp.
All right, fine. So we'll be back in just a minute to get to the rest of the story. All right, go ahead, Anita. Tell us, continue the story.
Okay, the next morning, they opened the doors, and we were all pulled out of our quarters, and the women were all loaded on horse-drawn wagons that were chauffeured by Polish prisoners of war. And two or three guards followed us. The men were kept behind with the main leader of the camp, who was a very cruel man. And we didn't know what was going to happen to the men, and I know one of my best friends was sitting next to me. Well, there were five of us girls that were always very close, and close through the Lord, too, and we prayed all the way while they were hauling us away, that if it was God's will, would he deliver us out of the hands of our persecutors? And we knew it would take a mighty miracle. But lo and behold, that morning, God performed that miracle. It was still dark outside. We were finally getting close to our destination, and we could make out, it was still, you know, through the lights here and there, we could make out there was a complex of barracks. In the middle of it, a smokestack rose into heaven, and it was surrounded by a very tall barbed wire fence that was electrically loaded. We knew this was another extermination camp. We didn't realize that so many of those were littering the countryside. Well, that morning, God performed a miracle to miracles, and I will make it real short, but he used literally angels in human form that helped the five of us to escape. And at one point when we were far, far enough from our persecutors, two went one way, three of us went another way, and the three of us found refuge in the home of the in-laws of one of my campmates. And there, that horrible infection that had started a few weeks earlier came to a head, and I was hospitalized, and most of the hospitals were run by Nazis, and I fell into the hands of a Nazi nurse. Of course, one thing was on my side. I had long, very thick blonde hair, and came from my father's side of the family, and nobody would ever have guessed I was Jewish. But this nurse was rambling on and talking about this wonderful leader of our country, and she went on and on and on. Well, she came back, then she left for a moment, and my friends leaned over me, and they said, whisper, don't say anything. And I said, no, of course not. Well, at first I was laying between white sheets, and the food was a little bit better than what we had in the camp. And the nurse was kind to me, and they had no antibiotics to cure the infection, so they wrapped some kind of stuff around my wound and strapped my leg to a splint.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Anita, of course, eventually was able to escape, but she had a very bad infection, so she's taken to a hospital. There, of course, she has a nurse who is a Nazi looking after her, who initially doesn't know that she is Jewish. So she's in the hospital. The nurse, of course, then discovers she's Jewish, but I'll let her tell the story. Go ahead.
It was a shortage on nurses and doctors and anesthesiologists and so forth, and of course no antibiotic, and the infection got worse and worse. My fever rose, and a kindly young lady doctor came in, and she saw my condition, and she said, we're going to have to drill some holes into your foot because we have no antibiotic. We see if we put tubes in there, if it would extract the pus. But under the anesthesia, which was ether, which was given to me by this Nazi nurse, I must have talked, because it's a known factor. I had an aunt who was a nurse who told me that sometimes those things happen. Well, I just prayed that I wouldn't say anything, but alas, I must have, because when I woke up, this nurse leaned over me and talked to the doctor, and she said, my, did that little girl ever talk a lot? And I knew in an instant what I must have said, because her kind attitude changed into sadistic pleasure. She became cruel because, you see, there was a medal for every Nazi, and she belonged to the Nazi party. There was a medal for every Nazi that would kill a Jew. So she took it upon herself and permitted very unsanitary conditions. And as a result, and she also kept the doctor from seeing me, which was very easy. But at one point, the doctor came back, and she said, we must cut more holes into the foot. So under the anesthesia, I went, and more holes were cut into my foot, and nothing happened. That nothing changed. It got worse because, there were dirty bandages that the nurse wouldn't change and so forth. And so the infection went into my thigh. And pretty soon, a big, hard lump would form in my inside of my right thigh, way up high. And I knew something was happening, and I kept telling the nurse that there's a lump in there, and she just mocked me and said some very cruel things to me and kept the doctor away. Well, I laid there swaying between life and death and kept praying because I always wanted to live for my mother, hoping that someday we might meet again. Well, the doctor finally came, and she just threw up her hands, and she said, oh, my God. Now, she posed as a Nazi doctor, but she wasn't, or else she would have never bothered to operate on me after the first surgery. So she cut, I went on the operating table, and they cut a big, deep hole about 2 inches wide and probably about 3 inches long, very deep, and they put tubes in there. And, of course, the wound was open, and so this was the opportunity for this Nazi nurse to do her dirty work. And she, I won't go into the gruesome details, but she permitted something to happen, that she gave me an enema and then put me on a bedpan for 2 hours, and all the feces and all the urine ran into the open wound and started more of an infection. And I was then getting very close to death. And at one point, my best friend came to see me again, and she saw my condition. She went to the doctor by night and pleaded with her to come and see me. See, the nurse had told the doctor that I was doing fine, and since the doctor had such an overload of patients, she was happy to see that I was doing well and didn't come to see me. So my girlfriend opened her eyes, and the next day, the doctor came, and when she saw my condition, she suspended the nurse from my case, and she risked her life doing so. So then she operated again, and one cut was enlarged, another one was made down near the knee, right above the knee, and then they dug a passage underneath, and then they put tubes from both ends in there, and it was a horribly painful operation. And I was so glad that she had suspended the nurse from me, because if she would have given me the anesthesia, a few more drops of ether, and I would have been gone. Well, finally, I was on the road to recover. And at one point, my girlfriend came, and she saw my horrible wound. She said I unwrapped it for her to show her, and she could not understand why God was permitting that. And I said, you know, God never makes a mistake. And I reminded her of Romans 8:28. When it says, and all things work together for good to them that love God, and so forth. And I told her that someday I have a feeling those wounds are going to be my protection. Well, I finally was allowed to get up, and I had to learn to walk all over again. And my muscles had shrunk and so forth, and my girlfriend came and steadied me. And on the fourth day, my leg was still, the tubes had been removed, but it was still draining very heavily and bandaged. On the fourth day, the Russians came, a fierce battle started, and all the patients were taken to an air raid shelter, one great big room, men, women, children, all. In fact, we had to triple up on our beds, with three people usually lying in one bed. And the Russians came to town, and they came into our basement and our shelter. They took away all our kerosene lamps. We just had little candles left. They took our food and everything. They started to rape women. And at one point, I was pulled from my bed. Two Russian soldiers in leather coats and heavy boots stood before me, stood over me. They threw me on a mattress on the floor, ripped off all my clothes, and they were going to rape me. And I was terrified. It was just like a scene out of hell. And I prayed, like, quietly. But when they saw my bandage, they thought I was faking, and they asked a student nurse to come over and unwrap this bandage. And when she unwrapped the last bit of the bandage, the pus just squirted out like a geyser, and I grossed these men out so badly they took off and ran. And ever thereafter, I was spared from being raped because of those wounds. So here it was, not knowing what was to happen, and I said to my girlfriend, God never makes a mistake. And he permitted all this for another reason, too, because at one point in the pause of fighting, I ventured out, I limped out into the outer hall of the air raid shelter, and there was this nurse sitting on the floor on a mattress, weeping profusely. I knew God was going to send me to her to comfort her, but I couldn't. I needed to ask the Lord to remove my bitterness, my anger, and put his love into my heart, because I also remembered that he died on the cross, not only for me, but for her too. And that he prayed at the last minute, God forgive them, because he didn't know what they were doing. And I also knew that he told us to love our enemies. It was hard. I needed his help for that. Well, I was finally able to comfort this nurse, and she wept on my shoulder, and she conveyed to me that she had been raped many times, and I wept with her. Then all of a sudden, she pushed herself away from me, and she said, how could you love me and comfort me? Don't you realize I tried to kill you? I said, yes, I know. But I said, through Christ and his help and his love, I'm able to forgive you. And pretty soon, the Germans drove the Russians back out of town. Later on, the Russians came back. But during that time, many of us were evacuated into the mountain area where it was still relatively safe. So I was separated from the nurse. I don't know what happened to her. Well, at one point then, the tubes had all been removed and I was able to limp along. I was told one morning, I'd been in the hospital now for 8 weeks, I was told, I need to go home. We don't have any room for you anymore. We don't have any beds enough, so go home. I didn't know where to go. I stood out there. I was limping along. I didn't have a cane or crutches. I just had to rely on Christ, that he was my crutch, my comfort. And he did not exactly permit for me to go on a very smooth road. I could tell you that for many, many weeks. The book is very condensed, doesn't talk too much about it, but I hitchhiked, I encountered some horrible situations, and finally the war was over. But the Lord did not send me on a smooth road, but he was with me every moment. And I read one time in my devotional that safety is not the absence of danger, but the presence of God. And I can vouch for that. Well, finally the war was over, and I had heard that my mother's camp had been liberated by the Russians. But I didn't know that she was still alive. I was given very little hope because there was a typhoid epidemic at the last minute, and I knew that they had been building gas chambers already, so I was given no hope. And I knew that if I wanted to find her again, I'd have to go to her camp. And I knew also that I would have to go through a land the Czechoslovakian people hated, the Germans. I spoke mostly German, remembered very little English from school. And I needed a passport, which I secured. And so one day, I started out. It was the 6th of June, 1945, a month after the liberation. And I didn't know how I was going to get to my mother. I just had to ask the Lord, lead me. And he provided the rides. As I said, I encountered some horrible things even on that trip. And finally, when I came to the end of my journey, I boarded a train that was supposed to take me partway to Theresienstadt. And on that train, I met a young man. Czech was Czech. And first, when he saw my blonde hair, he looked at me sternly. He asked me if I was German. He said that in Czech. Not a very complimentary term for the Germans either, but I had enough time to pull out of my pant pockets a passport that I had secured, which was in Russian, Czech, and English, which told that I was a victim of Nazis and that I had been persecuted for a long time and that I was on route to Theresienstadt. And when he read that, his eyes softened. In fact, he filled with tears. And he hugged me, and in a very broken German, he conveyed to me, he said, I am a Jew too. And I have been incarcerated, I've lost my entire family. He said, I will help you. I will see to it that I help you to your road to Theresienstadt. Well, when I met him, I was very suspicious because I had encountered some horrible situations, not only with Russians, but with American soldiers too. But the Lord has always spared me from the worst. But he was sincere. And when we came to Prague, which was his hometown, he walked with me. He spoke for me. He protected me. And finally, we boarded another train, and at that next place in Leitmeritz, he said goodbye to me, and he handed me over to a Czech police officer, gave him some money to take me to my mother's camp. And you know, when I turned around, wanted to thank this beautiful man, it was like he vanished in the crowd. And I turned to my new escort and I said, you know, I think God has just sent me another angel. Do you want me to stop here or can
no,
I
you
finish?
Go right ahead,
yeah.
Please.
And so this lovely police officer spoke some German and he chatted along and he said, you know, when I told him, I said, God just sent me another angel. He said, we just pray that the same God will get us there safely and that your mother is still alive. Well, finally, we came to my mother's camp, and we had heard that there had been a typhoid epidemic, but that it had been cleaned up. And so the guards were heavily guarded. I mean, the gates, excuse me, were heavily guarded by a Russian police that had orders not to let anybody in. And there was a big poster on the brick walls that surrounded the camp that showed the skull and the crossbones, and it said camp under quarantine, entrance forbidden. And they had their orders not to let anybody in. I tell you, I came to the end of my rope. I started to weep profusely because I thought, have I come this far, you know, and I can't even get in. And my escort pleaded with them in their own language to let me in, and I guess their hearts softened and they let me in. Well, when I finally came to the building where I was supposed to find out if my mother was alive or not, it was very I was terrified. I was turned into a coward. I prayed. I said, Lord, please give me strength to accept your will, whatever happened. And I was very much to my surprise. My mother had survived. It was a great day. It was the 7th of June. 1945, finally, after all these many months, 18 months we were separated, and for 11 months we had no news from each other. I tell you, it was wonderful that the Lord finally brought us back together. It was a miracle that my mother survived, because just 24 hours were left at one point when their gas chambers were to be completed. And the Nazis there forced the male inmates to build the gas chambers. And it was those last, there were 24 hours left for them to be completed when Switzerland sent a representative of the Red Cross. And I mean, there was still war going on between the Russians and the Germans, and the Nazis were still completely in control. But that man found out that those shower rooms that he was told were gas chambers. And he went and took his Red Cross vehicle with a flag of surrender and the flag of the Red Cross and drove through fierce fighting, survived, got to the Russian commander, told him all about it, and pleaded with them to go save the people, and they did. So they used to, it was a known factor that the Germans would use the cremains and the fat of the cremated Jews, and that they would make soap out of it. And my mother was joking. She said, you know, 24 more hours and I would have been a cake of soap. It sounded funny, but it wasn't. Then she shared things with me, and I finally shared with her what happened to me. But we were just so grateful to God that he had protected us. I mean, that both of us were alive was a miracle of miracles. And then after about 3 weeks, the Russians chartered military trucks, British and Americans, and they transported us to a refugee camp in Bavaria. We couldn't go to England. England wouldn't accept new residents. We got in touch with my sister. So then an organization in America, the ACCR, the American Christian Committee for Refugees, they sponsored our trip. And again, on the 7th of June, a very significant date, we started to sail for America, 11 days. And on the 17th, all of us young people stayed up all night long on the top deck. We were going to be the first ones to see the Statue of Liberty. And it was a very foggy morning, and we all rejoiced. And then everybody came up on deck. And I tell you, it was utter silence. There was not a dry eye. And people were praising God, those that believed in him, that at last we were free.
And I'm sure the people who came here at that time appreciated the freedom that so many Americans today more or less take for granted.
Yes, very much so. It was a great experience. Our organization then found us a place to go to in Nyack, New York, where we stayed for 2.5 months, and then we met some very lovely people there that took us under their wings, and the organization permitted them to take us to the Middle West. And we were so blessed because my mother found a job. I was able to go to college. I worked very hard, worked my way through, and had scholarships here and there, and finally became a teacher. My mother...
Hold the thought here, and we'll just be back in just a moment.
Yeah.
Our guest has been Anita Dietman, his book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell. Well, anyway, you got your degree, and you then worked for many years as a teacher here in the United States?
Yes, I did. And ultimately, I got married and had two children, and they're grown up. They live in the Twin City area. And I will be, I have a speaking engagement on, let's see, the 10th of September, and I'll be visiting with my children there, too. So I praise God every day for being in this country. I know it's not perfect, and I see with horror, though, in these 60 years that I've been here now, that society has decayed. Things have changed drastically from when I first came. It was a God-fearing country, and I'm afraid this is getting less and less so, and I feel very bad. I pray daily for our president, for our soldiers, and especially for our country.
Well, I appreciate the fact you're doing that, and of course we do what we do, trying to reawaken in the American people the realization that if we turn our back on God, then God will one day turn our back on, or his back on this country. So if we don't have a revival in this country, I don't see there's going to be a great deal of future. But I do what I do, hoping that cumulatively with the work of so many other people out there, the American people are eventually going to understand that freedom comes from God. It doesn't come from government. In fact, the one thing we need to do is limit the power of government and allow people to be free. And, of course, the whole secret of America really was people were ruled by God. They weren't ruled by government. People who could look after themselves and take care of themselves with God's help can be free. But, of course, it was Thomas Pamia, it was William Penn, who said those will not be ruled by God, will be ruled by tyrants. Unfortunately, most people don't understand that what that's all about. And they think when we talk about being ruled by God, we want somehow a theocracy. The last thing in the world we would want would be a theocracy.
Right.
What we want is, of course, a nation of moral people. But people cannot be moral on their own. They need God's guidance. Well, Anita, thank you so very much for being with us again and telling your story. I love it every time I hear it. And I
learn more. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me again. It was a pleasure.
Good night.
You're a wonderful interviewer. I said that before.
Oh, well, I don't have to do very much. That's a nice thing. All I have to do is...
That's a nice thing, yes, to give me the chance to tell the story, and I really appreciate that because people need to hear it.
They do over and over again. Good night. God bless you.
God bless you, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, of course, our guest was Anita Dietman, the book Trapped in Hitler's Hell, and, of course, it's available from Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed Anita's story. If you would like to get the entire tape of tonight's program, it's available. We have other interviews with Anita, and we have several other interviews with a gentleman who lives not too far from us, who was actually at Auschwitz, and he was 14 or 15, and his job was to pull the people, shower rooms after they'd been gassed, and of course then to get their clothes off and the gold out of their teeth and things of that sort. And a lot of people out there say it didn't happen. Well, that's part of the planned program of facilitating anti-Semitism today. And believe me, anti-Semitism is growing in America, and it bodes very, very poorly for our country. I was in Germany after the Second World War. I saw the ruins of that country, in part because of what they did to the Jews, and I fear that the same thing could well happen here. Well, if you'd like to get, of course, Anita's book, why it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. That's Trapped in Hitler's Hell. And, of course, you'd like to get the complete tape or of that and my other interviews with people in the Holocaust. I think we'll be putting together a four-tape set, but you can get the individual tape of her story, the complete story that was told this evening. It's a powerful, powerful story. And then, of course, how do we understand Hitler? How do we understand what motivated Hitler? Well, Hitler was motivated by his association with Theosophy. He was a disciple of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. In fact, the History Channel has a 3 or 4 hour special on this called The Cult in the Third Reich. We recommend it. Usually don't recommend things for Hitler's from the History Channel, but this is well worthwhile watching. And then, of course, to understand the forces behind Theosophy and Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to, of course, get the video or DVD that goes along with that to begin to understand the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged today, why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools. Everybody knows that the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools, but no one will tell you why they took God and prayer out of our schools. And, of course, we cover that and document it in our book, Brotherhood of Darkness. We hope many of you out there will want to get some of the videos we carry. Well, well done, very professionally done. Like, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, the 3 hour, the 4 hour, the 10 hour version of that. And it's available both in DVD and in video. And then, of course, we have Joe Schimmel's latest production. It's called The Da Vinci Code, or Da Vinci Con, and Joe Schimmel, Pastor Joe Schimmel, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. He'll be with us for 2 hours tomorrow evening. You'll certainly want to see Chris Pinto's award-winning video or DVD, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and then, of course, you'd certainly want to get Megiddo 1 and Megiddo 2, which Chris Pinto had done. We have so much information of Radio Liberty that will help you understand the true spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged today. So please go to our website at www.radioliberty.com, or you can of course listen to our programs on the internet directly or indirectly, 5 hours a day. And then, of course, you can look at some of the items that we have that do help us stay on the air, items like the Berkey water filter and the health products that many of them my wife and I take help us to preserve our health, and you need to have a good supply of them. If you'd like to get our health catalog, we'd be glad to send it to you free of charge. Of course, we really hope that you're going to want to get some of the books or the various items that we have, the health products, which you need to have a good stock on. We are moving towards war in the United States today. We're moving towards a war in the Middle East. And just as, of course, the people of Germany lost their freedom when Hitler went to war, so I feel that they're using the threat of terrorism in the coming war to restrict the freedom of the American people. Understand what's going on. Understand the times. Remember, our Lord was asked when he'd return, and he said, as it was in the days of Noah. And could it be anything more today than like it was at the time of Noah? A nation that was totally corrupt, totally depraved, and that's what's happened to America today. So pray for America, pray for revival, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, this evening we have with us Orlean Kula, who is the president of the Eagle Forum here in California and her county up there around Santa Rosa. And Orlean's going to tell us about the new proposition they have in her area, which is designed to take away the property rights of people who have property which is adjacent to a river or to a creek. And this is something that is being done all over the United States as part of Agenda 21. There is a plan for a fascist America. It's laid out in something called the Global Biodiversity Assessment. It came out of the Second Earth Summit. It can be called Agenda 21. It can be called Sustainable Development. There is a basic program, Agenda 21. You can get a copy of it from the United Nations, or we actually have the Agenda 21 program that was laid out here in Santa Cruz, right? Lived back about 1991, 1992, because Santa Cruz has always been an area where these things were tried out ahead of time, and even before the United Nations had come out with this program, and it is a United Nations program, it is a program of the world fascists who want to control everything that you do, everything you think, everything you have. And they want to control your property. They want to get you out of your cars. And that's why they're running up the price of gasoline. There's no shortage of oil in the world, contrary to everything you're saying. The Saudi oil minister said there's no shortage of oil. So why is oil up over $70 a barrel? Why, very simply, to get the price up, to manipulate you and get you out of your cars. And you don't think it's going to go up a lot higher? It is going to go a lot higher. And they're going to force you out of your cars. And they're going to force you to conserve energy. And we had the deregulation of electricity here in California. It was sold to the people of the state, and in fact, they were going to lower the cost of electricity. And what did it do? It doubled the cost of electricity. And that's what it was supposed to do. Unless you understand, almost everything going on is designed to manipulate the American people. To cause us to conserve, to stop using so much oil and electricity and power, and then take away our property rights. That's such an important thing. And that's what we're going to be talking about with Orlean this evening. Orlean, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Stan, and for that great introduction.
Why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners what's happening up there in your county?
Well, about a month ago, some of us received a little yellow card in the mail announcing that they were going to have a series of hearings for any property owner that had a creek or a stream or a river running through their property. And these hearings would tell us what this entailed. My husband didn't think much of it, and I said, uh-oh, this is really serious, because I already knew a lot about Agenda 21 from listening to your wonderful radio programs, and we've had Michael Shaw come here and speak for us, as well as you. And so I thought, oh no, this is coming to my county. So I then attended these hearings with my husband and found out what this was all about.
Well, of course, this is a plan that is being implemented all across America. We've talked to people up in the state of Washington where this is being implemented. We've talked to people on the East Coast where it's being implemented. And Michael Shaw, who's here in Santa Cruz, who leads Freedom 21, is on top of this. He understands that this is a coordinated plan. People think it's just something in their county. It's not in their county. It's a nationwide, it's a worldwide plan to take away property rights in the name of, course, preserving the creeks and the fishies and the springs and the rivers for posterity. But really, of course, it's a matter of taking away your property. Well, Orlean, you pick up the story there.
We found by attending these hearings that there was going to be a 100-foot setback on both sides of a creek. It didn't even matter if it was a dry creek or a a flowing creek, it didn't seem to matter how large or how small, that you still had a 100-foot setback on both sides. And for the Russian River, it was a 200-foot setback. What they meant by these setbacks was you could not use your land. You couldn't plow it, couldn't grow anything on it, you could not build on it. If there was an existing building, you were allowed to go on using that, but if it ever needed repairs or if it burned down, you could not rebuild it. There was also a stipulation that if you needed to build a fence, the fence could only be a wildlife-friendly fence, which meant it had 18 inches underneath open space and it could only be 4 feet tall. One man at these hearings said, that's not a fence, that's a clothesline, and that's not going to keep anything out. If you were trying to keep crawlers from coming on your property, of course, that would not be any problem at all for them to crawl over. If you were trying to keep deer from coming in and eating all your plants, that wouldn't do anything. So essentially, it's just exercising total control over your land. They did tell us that we shouldn't be too upset. You could have a bird bath and a sandbox on your property, as if that was going to make us feel better.
Now, do you actually have any sort of streams or creeks on your property there?
Yes, we have an 8-acre parcel, and about 3 acres will be affected by a creek that runs through our property.
And, of course, this is what they're doing, Chris, and it can be a dry creek. It doesn't even have to have any water in it. If it's ever been a creek, you no longer own that property, and there's no compensation, is there?
No, that's the other thing. You get to pay taxes on it, but there's no compensation for the fact that they're actually taking your land. If you can't use it, that's essentially what has happened to it.
And so what's the justification for doing this, Aline?
Well, they're pretending that property owners just are not taking good enough care of the stream beds, that there's a lot of erosion, and then they're also calling it corridors, so I guess little migrating animals could come through. Good grief, with a 200 feet, you know, 100 foot on both sides, you could have a herd of elephants or elk, but we don't seem to have those in California, nor do we have any migrating species at all. The deer stay here, the turkeys stay here, nothing migrates. So there's really no sense to it other than the fact they are trying to take land. Some of the wineries in Sonoma County are really going to suffer. There's one called the Kendall Jackson Winery that stands to lose 8,000 acres.
Now hold that thought. We're going to be right back here in just a moment with Orlean Coolin. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Orlean Coolin, and she's telling about the program that they have up in Santa Rosa where, I mean, there's one winery that's talking about they're going to lose something. Is it 8,000 acres?
8,000 acres.
8,000 acres. Orlean's going to, they have a little creek or stream on their property. They're going to lose their 8 acres. They're going to lose 3 acres of it. Of course, decreases the value of their property. But even if they stay there, so much of their property they can't do anything on. And what this is simply a plan. It's an international plan. Now, most people don't understand that there are really some very evil and wicked people, people of great wealth, who the people who met at the Second Earth Summit in 1992, people like Maurice Strong and Al Gore, and of course you can get the actually, of course, that wonderful book written by Joan Vian about the Sustainable Prince. The whole plan was laid out by Prince Charles and his group of wealthy and powerful people who met on the British Royal Yacht prior to the 1992 meeting and laid out this whole plan by which the ruling elite would begin to gain more and more control over people's property and their rights and their freedoms in the name of course, protecting the environment. Those of you remember when Prince Charles came to America about a year and a half ago with his bride, who he had been having an affair with before. Of course, the Princess Diana had a very strange death. But Prince Charles talked about sustainable communities. He went to visit sustainable communities. The elite know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want us common folks to know. So what sort of response did the Board of Supervisors have for this? And did they understand what they were really doing, or had they been elected specifically to put through this confiscation of property?
Before I answer that question, I wanted to just read what Maurice Strong that you mentioned has listed as what is not sustainable. He says, current lifestyles and consumption patterns of the affluent middle class mainly Americans, involving high meat intake, such as cattle production, use of fossil fuels, air and auto travel, industrial and consumer products, appliances such as refrigeration, home and work, air conditioning, and suburban housing. All these are not sustainable. So essentially, every aspect of our life is not sustainable. Well, anyway, fortunately, because of my connection with you and Michael Shaw, I had ordered some of those wonderful brochures, the little booklets that Michael Shaw has put out called Understanding Sustainable Development, Agenda 21, A Guide for Public Officials. And when I spoke at the hearing, see, what they do, you're not even speaking before the Board of Supervisors. They have set up these little commissions, and these commissions are non-governmental agents that you wonder, who are these people and how can we get rid of them? If it were our Board of Supervisors, they are accountable to us, and we could say, we are outraged, we're not going to vote for you again. But they have these commissions that they've appointed, and you plead your case before them, and supposedly they are taking notes. There's a court reporter writing everything down, and you can submit your letters to them, and one person gets one opportunity to speak. The first hearing, there were 600 outraged property owners and maybe two environmentalists who spoke in favor of this. The second hearing, there were 400 outraged property owners. The third meeting, 200. And finally, the last meeting, maybe 100. And then the environmentalists turned out in full glory. There were probably 50 of them speaking in favor of this. And one woman said, you know, I've been at all four hearings, and I've been keeping a tally of everything. And those who are in favor of this plan far outnumber those who are opposed. You know, just lying to her teeth. And of course, there was a groan in the audience. We knew the truth about this. But when I spoke, I brought these little packets with me. I also brought a copy of the Constitution and one for the California Constitution. And I told them, I said, I grew up on a farm in Idaho. My father started his farm from desert land where there was nothing but sagebrush and lava rock covering it. Year after year, we would help him load the lava rock away and the sagebrush, and he'd clear a little bit more land and eventually have more in cultivation. Finally, he was able to dig a well, and then the desert land began to blossom like a rose. And I said that was his general plan. His general plan was to get up early in the morning at 5 o'clock and work till 9 o'clock at night. And there was no control from the government telling him what he could do and what he couldn't do. And that was called the American Dream, the free enterprise system. I said, your general plan, 2020, all of these plans have the 2020 attached to them because that's when they hope to totally implement this. I said, your general plan is going to totally destroy the free enterprise system, totally destroy the American dream. No longer will we be able to do with our own land what we would like to do. And then I told them that some of us had organized, we had a property rights group formed, and we had a petition, and I read to them some of the things from our petition, which are mainly quoting from the California, the U.S. Constitution and the California Constitution, how this was in violation of our rights. And then at the end, I presented, I said, obviously there's a book you have not yet read, and I'm going to give you a copy of it as a gift. And then I also gave them a copy of Sustainable Development from Agenda 21 from Santa Cruz. And I gave them that as my letter to them, a copy of the Constitution and this little plan, Agenda 21. And I spoke today for the Board of Supervisors, and I told them, I said, it wasn't on the agenda, I just had to speak in the open hearing part. I said, some of us have gone through a whole month of these hearings where you had an appointed commission that was supposed to tell us what we could do with our property. And I told them, you are the ones that are going to be held accountable for this because you appointed the commission. You are our elected officials, and we have a petition that is asking for you to please reject this entire plan and remember your oath of office that you took to uphold the Constitution. And in that Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, it tells you that your whole purpose for government and for being government officials is to support and protect and secure our rights of life, liberty, and property. And then I gave them a copy of Understanding Sustainable Development and an invitation to come and hear you speak when you come here on September 16th.
Oh, you mean you invited them to come here?
Yes.
Come here and speak, huh?
I thought that would be wonderful.
Incidentally, I'm going to be up on the 16th of September speaking at Orleans Conference there. Would you like to put a plug in how people get in touch with you and learn more about that conference? Is it going to be, what, all morning or all day?
It starts in the morning. It's our fifth annual Constitution Day breakfast, and it starts at 8:30 till 9:30 for breakfast, and then the program starts from 9:30 till 1. And it's just a morning until 1 o'clock conference. But we have not only you speaking, we have Michael Shaw talking about the attack on property rights. And then Dr. Stan Monteith is going to be talking about other threats to our Constitution, our American heritage, and our sovereignty. And then our last speaker is an author and a historian named Catherine Dang. She's going to be talking about repairing the breach between the individual and the Constitution, restoring local self-government. You know, with how these councils are set up, it's like we don't even have local self-government anymore, and it's really based on the United Nations system, or it's really based on the Soviet system of setting up little commissions that they're not elected officials, non-governmental organizations, and it muddies the water, and you're so confused. You know, who are these people, and how do we get rid of them?
Well, I think you have to understand that Maurice Strong is a very close friend of Mikhail Gorbachev and Stephen Rockefeller. The Rockefeller's been pushing socialism. The family's been pushing it for 100 years, and the Rockefeller Foundation is one of the major financiers of the socialist and the communist movement here in the United States. Of course, Mikhail Gorbachev is a dedicated communist, and certainly Maurice Strong was the number two man at the United Nations. He's a multi-billionaire. The only good thing I can say is, I mean, he's got billions of dollars of his own, and he actually took a couple of million dollars from Saddam Hussein, or was involved with the oil for food, and of course taking money from Saddam Hussein. He's over hiding out in China today. That's the only good thing I can say about Maurice Strong. He was forced to give up his position as number two man at the United Nations, the man who really ran the United Nations. Why would a man who's got billions of dollars risk everything to get a couple of million dollars, you know, from Saddam Hussein? Well, very simply, he's corrupt, he's evil and wicked. And here's the man who is really the architect of this whole sustainable development situation, along with Al Gore and Prince Charles. And all of these people of great wealth work together. And what do they really want? They want to control us. That's what it's about. It's a move towards the institution of a feudalistic system under a wealthy and powerful ruling elite.
I'm so glad you keep mentioning the word feudalism, because most Americans don't even know what that is. If you look it up in the dictionary, the definition of, well, feudalism and fascism. Fascism is it's private property rights, but with total government control, and that's exactly what the plan is for Sonoma County. We'll be allowed to go on owning our property and paying taxes on it, but we'll have government control over every aspect of it. And I wanted to also mention Gorbachev. 6 months before the Berlin Wall came down, he had already made arrangements for his global office for running Greenpeace to be set up at Presidio in San Francisco. So this obviously was not, this whole plan was not by coincidence that supposedly communism failed and was now dead. It was really a part of the plan to step one step forward, two steps forward, one step backward. That's right.
And, of course, Gorbachev, of course, the fall of the Soviet Union was as phony as a $3 bill. How else could they get us to begin pouring money in there and helping them? They convince us that communism is dead. But if communism is dead, why do 1.25 billion people live under communism in China and live under communism in Cuba and in Vietnam and North Korea? And you know, it's amazing what you convince people of. It doesn't matter how ridiculous it is, if you say it often enough, people will believe communism is dead. Well, I guess this evening is early and cooler. And do you think you had any impact at all on your board of supervisors? Is there any way that you could launch a recall and use this as a vehicle, you know, to popularize and let people understand that, you know, that if they can take away your property rights, they can take away their property rights too. This is just the first step of taking away property rights.
That's right. Well, that's part of our plan. If the petition that we are going to start circulating does not work, we're hoping that the Board of Supervisors will realize when hundreds of thousands of signatures start coming in, we may not be reelected if we don't reject this plan. If that doesn't work, then we could start a recall of them. We also are thinking of trying to get a statewide initiative similar to what they have in Oregon. Oregon recently passed Measure 37, which will make the government and its appointed commissions have to pay for any taking of privately owned land, no matter what silly excuse they have for taking it. And but this would be a huge endeavor, but that's maybe what we can do. We have irate people all over California that are going through similar situations, and if we could possibly get a statewide initiative, that would be really wonderful.
Well, I think what people have to understand, it's really all about property. What we have are people who have a different worldview. They think that they have the right to control everybody. There's always people who wanted to control the lives of others, and these people get elected to office, and then they use their position to violate the oath that they've sworn, which is to uphold our Constitution, and they do everything they can to undermine it, because our Constitution guarantees property rights, both at the federal and at the state level, and certainly the Declaration of Independence, which is the really almost like the Articles of Incorporation of our Constitution, talks about the importance of life, liberty, and property. And it was that idea of property that is so vitally important.
That's right. The words pursuit of happiness really meant what you could now do because you were a property owner.
In fact, if you look in the Constitution, every place they talk about life, liberty, they always mention property. There's two places. In fact, the original term had come from John Locke, who talked about life, liberty, and property. When Jefferson had originally drafted the Declaration, he talked about life, liberty, and property. The committee changed it to pursuit of happiness, but where both places in the Constitution they mention life and liberty, they also mention property. They go together. Property rights are the very essence of individual freedom. That is why they want to take away property rights. And these evil and wicked people who are being elected to office by a coordinated effort of the media and the people, a very, very small group of people, but they're coordinated. They want to control us, and they get away with it because we want to be left alone. But they're totally dedicated to the control of every aspect of human endeavor and the crushing of the human spirit.
That's really the truth. And our founding fathers, I have some quotes by both George Washington and John Adams. George Washington said, private property and freedom are inseparable. John Adams said, property must be secured or liberty cannot exist. All of our founding fathers knew how important the owning of property was for freedom because they'd come from this terrible, tyrannical England where King George owned everything. And they knew that that's what they wanted for our nation. And for our elected officials to just ignore that, it's really outrageous.
Well, our job, of course, is to get the people informed and educated. And I do hope that many of our listeners out there will want to be coming to your meeting. And when we get back, I'm going to have to get the telephone number out for people to call.
That would be wonderful.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, our guest is Orlean Kulov. Orlean, how can people get in touch with you and learn more about this meeting you're going to be having? Is it the 13th?
It's the 16th.
The 16th of September, right.
And for those of our listening audience who don't know, the reason we're doing this, it was September 17th, 1787, that our Constitution was signed into law. Hardly anyone even knows that anymore, nor do they celebrate that day, even though this is the greatest document that was ever created. And that's why this is our fifth annual Constitution Day celebration. We always try to have a very special event. People can go online and go to our website, which is www.eagleforumofcalifornia.com. And right there on the very front page, you'll see the information about our September 16th event, and they can just download the registration form. And we would love for a large number to come. It's going to be held at the Santa Rosa Christian Church, which is on Pacific in Santa Rosa, and it's very easy to find. If you would like more information, you can also call my phone number at 707-539-8393.
Give that number one more time.
707-539-8393.
All right, fine. And so we'd hope that many people will make it a point to want to come to the meeting. And that, of course, is the Santa Rosa Eagle Forum. And I'll be there. Michael Shaw will be there. I know this woman who's going to be speaking. I've never actually met her, but I've heard of her for many years. And she's written extensively about our Constitution, which is the very foundation of our freedom.
That's right. I would also like to mention I have several copies of your wonderful book, Sustainable Development, an Exposé of the Origins and Goals of Modern-Day Environmentalists. And this is, I think, a fantastic book that I've been using for reference as well. So I hope you'll bring lots of copies of that when you come.
Oh, we certainly will. And we'll bring along our four-tape set on sustainable development, our video on sustainable development. And people have to understand that this is a planned program. These people know exactly what they're doing. And they move in individual communities, but they coordinate all over the world. This is not even simply in the United States. This is a worldwide movement to bring about a world feudalistic society. So,
and it's also something how they begin to change the name. If someone is familiar with Agenda 21, then they call it smart growth or something else that will deceive people, conservation easements, anything that will make it sound like they're just thinking out for the best of the community and the county, but that's not at all the case. And I highly advise anyone going online and just Googling Agenda 21, and you'll be amazed the information that comes up.
And, of course, they really want to get us off of our cars. They want to get us onto bicycles. And here in Santa Cruz, they're putting in all these bicycle lanes and bicycle paths and paved bicycle paths that they really expect to get people out of their cars. This is part of an organized plan. They really would like to have a society that, like the one that used to exist in Beijing, where everybody was on a bicycle. Now, of course, everybody in Beijing is getting into cars, and they want to get us out of our cars. And as incredible as it may seem, if you read their writings, they really want to do away with industrial society. They want to do away with civilized society. If you read the Global Biodiversity Assessment, which is an 1,142-page a book that was actually published by the Cambridge University Press, came out in out of the Second Earth Summit in 1992, they want to bring the world back to the way it was before the wicked white man came. They want to markedly limit the population of the world. They want to destroy existing religious belief. They want to replace it with a new spirituality. And they believe there are just too many people in the world, and we're going to have to do something to get rid of an awful lot of them. And you say, that's crazy talk. Well, it may be crazy talk, but these people on the other side often hold the reins of power. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Lee, and I think this is such an important subject, we haven't talked about it in some time, but believe me, our enemies never sleep. They know what they're doing. Go ahead, Arlene.
Well, I have been investigating this for about 15 years because I'm a substitute teacher in the public schools, and I had heard about sustainable development and Agenda 21, and I was really concerned what was going on, but I never thought, I always thought it was far away and was not going to affect my own life. Lo and behold, here it is in our own backyard.
And I guess it is your own backyard. They're going to take three acres of your property, and I'm sure this is going to take a significant part of the land up in this Santa Rosa County.
That's
but
right.
Believe me, under one guise or another, they're going to impose this every place. They're going to use water to restrict your building, to restrict even the amount of water you can drink. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Orlene Kula. We're talking about the whole move towards sustainable development. We're talking about really what it involves. They want to control the water. If they can control the water, they can control you. They want to get you out of your car and onto a bicycle. They want to be able to take away your property rights. They want to be able to determine how much water you're used to flush your toilets with. They want to regulate every aspect of what you're doing. They certainly don't want you having wood stoves or, getting heat that way. And they certainly want to limit your ability to use electricity because they're running the price up intentionally. And they don't want you to use coal and other things because you're polluting the environment. And you're causing global warming by using fossil fuels. And you say, how are you going to stay warm? How are you going to stay cool? During the recent heat spell, I saw that they had this ad they were running, and they said, turn down your air conditioner to 78. 78? I mean, at 78, you might as well not even put on the air conditioner. But this is the way these people think. Now, believe me, they're not going to restrict their use of air conditioning. They're not going to give up their cars or their airplanes. It's just the common folks are going to regulate.
That's true. What is interesting in this general plan that they have for Santa Rosa is not only talking about the streams and the rivers and the creek setbacks, but they have two other aspects called scenic resource issues. And in that, they are saying that anyone who builds a home up on a cliff looking down in Rincon Valley, which is, you know, a very beautiful property, they will no longer be able to even their view because they have to totally screen their home with topography and vegetation so no one can see it. It's more important for the passing motorist to have his rights met that he can look up and not see a home than for the homeowners to have any rights. There's also something in this called light pollution. If a person has a motion detector that comes on in the middle of the night because of a prowler or a deer or something, this will be taboo because that is destroying the beautiful view that his neighbor might have who might be out gazing at the stars in the middle of the night. So it's just ludicrous. Who would have ever thought that a motion detector was called light pollution? And then another aspect of this is called biotic resource, biotic habitat areas. Some of the people who have spoken at these hearings said that they had circles on the map of their land and asked what this meant. Whether there was a circle, it meant that there was some kind of a biotic habitat area, an endangered species, or wetland.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Orlene Kulev, and of course she's from the Santa Rosa Eco Forum, and they are having a meeting up there. And certainly if you have an opportunity, you should go. And that's on September 16th. And once again, get your telephone number out, your webpage, Orlene, please.
Yes, they can find out more information by going to www.ecoforumofcalifornia.com. Or they can call me, 707-539-8393. And this is going to be a wonderful day that we're celebrating the signing into law of our Constitution. Dr. Stan is going to be one of our speakers. Michael Shaw, an attorney from Santa Cruz area, will be talking about property rights and how they are being taken. Dr. Stan is going to be talking about other aspects of how our Constitution is being threatened and our American heritage and our sovereignty. And then Catherine Dang, a historian, is going to be talking about repairing the breach between the individual and the Constitution, restoring local self-government. We also have a skit by some teenagers portraying the founders of our Constitution, which should be really cute. They're going to be dressed in full costume. And I am going to be speaking on the inspiration and greatness of the U.S. Constitution.
Sounds like an exciting time. I'm really looking forward to it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And this move towards sustainable development, Agenda 21, smart growth, call it what you will. It's all part of the same program. They want, of course, to tear down the dams across America that are used to generate hydroelectricity and, of course, to control floods. Flood control? Oh, no, we can't have those dams. They're interfering with the migration of the fish, and so we've got to go ahead and tear the dams down, and they're doing this all across America. We have pictures of people from Fish and Wildlife clubbing the salmon, clubbing them, and then electrocuting the salmon. Why? So they can get shortages, so they can justify ever more control over the water. This is what they do. They're not interested in the solution. They're not interested in the fishies. They're not interested in the wildlife. They're interested in control.
And when I was first graduated from high school, I worked in Yellowstone Park, and I saw a total different Yellowstone Park than it is now. I was there 2 years ago with my sister, and we noticed so many roads that have been closed, just like you said. And so if there is a fire, how do you get in there? Well, they don't even believe in putting fires out anymore. In fact, I spoke to a ranger. He said, oh, yes, we believe that if the fire starts by lightning, then it is natural, and we have to let it burn. If it was started by man, campfire or something, then we'll try to put it out.
And, of course, the other thing is, of course, they won't allow timbering on so much of government land or even on private land, you know, because they want to save the trees. And yet, at least the people who own the forest, they're in there, they're their trees they want to preserve, and they're going to prevent the forest fires. On the other hand, when the government comes in, they won't let the people clean up the forest. They won't let them lumber the trees. And then the fire comes and they let it burn. What madness is this? It's not madness at all. They know exactly what they're doing. They don't want people building houses with all that wood that's available. They really want, of course, if you read what they say, they want to return us to the way it was when the deer and the buffalo roamed over the plains. And you say, that's crazy talk. Well, there may be crazy talk to you and me, but it's not crazy talk to them. They have an agenda. They know exactly what they're doing. I think one of the best analyses of this was written by Tom Clancy in a book called Rainbow Six. And if you haven't read it, as Tom Clancy says in the foreword of the book, why, there's a lot of information in this book that the government doesn't want you to know. It's a book about mass genocide, and it all gets back to this concept of sustainable development. The only way we're going to have sustainable development is to do away with so many people. There's too many people on Earth today, and believe me, ladies and gentlemen, they're in the process of doing away with these people, but you're not being told what's really going on behind the scenes. That is not unless you listen to Radio Liberty. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. And, of course, the pamphlet that Orlean is talking about that Michael Shaw has put on sustainable development is very good. We have a syllabus on sustainable development, a talk on sustainable development, a video on sustainable development. You need to have the background. You need to know what this is about. You need to get a copy of the Santa Cruz Agenda 21. And, of course, you can get the Agenda 21 by calling the United Nations headquarters back in New York City. That's where I got my copy of Agenda 21. It is the agenda for the 21st century that we live in today, an agenda designed to change everything, to change our way of life, and to eliminate a large part of the world's population. Well, Orlean, certainly you must have a lot of people up there in Santa Rosa who are very concerned about what's going on. Are they getting educated? Are they beginning to understand what this is really about?
Well, the first hearing that I attended, I came with some little blue flyers inviting any concerned property owner to come to a meeting. I had arranged for a meeting at the Klein Cellars. Remember Nancy Klein? She was on your program a few times.
Sure.
Well, they are also being affected. They have a stream that runs through their property, and they were very kind to allow us to meet at their winery. And we had about 30 people that came, and these people are very concerned. And I, fortunately, had ordered these little pamphlets on sustainable development, gave each one right then. So we began to educate them from the very beginning. They all came back to the second meeting, and we have now elected a board of directors, and they are going online and researching on their own. The whole world is opening up to them now. They're really finding out what this is all about.
I think it's really, unfortunately, most people don't get concerned until it affects them.
That's true. And you can't think that evil could be so organized and so well thought out that when you see it right there in action, taking away the rights and property of all these wonderful, hardworking people. One man at the hearing testified that he would have 100% of his land taken because he has 8 streams running through it. How absolutely ludicrous. Something that used to be a great blessing to have water right on your own land is now going to be such a terrible liability that you can't even use your land. The whole thing is just ludicrous.
Well, it's not ludicrous if you understand what the ultimate goal is, and that is to control the private property. And that's one of the basic tenets of the Communist Manifesto. That is one of the basic tenets of these people who want to control everything. And they do it legally through the form of government. And, you know, how can you object? After all, we're a nation of laws, aren't we? No, we've got lawless people working behind the scenes and actively involved in a conspiracy to deprive people of their rights and of their freedoms and of their property.
One of the ladies who spoke at the first hearing, after hearing these 600 outraged people speaking who owned land, and she was from the Sierra Club, and she said, you know, I just can't understand why all of you property owners are so upset. This land is my land. This land is your land. No one is supposed to own Mother Earth. We all own it together. So you can see these avid environmentalists truly believe that private ownership of property is something evil. And they are determined to not allow us to have any.
Well, I think that, of course, is very well until you came over there to take her land, and then she'd be right up there yelling and screaming.
Unless some of these people are just all renters. I wanted to ask, what tent do you live in? But I think you're right. Most of them probably are very wealthy. They just enjoy controlling and exercising control over everyone else's lives. And I do believe the whole movement is being run by greed and power. And, of course, then there's this deep ecology that many people truly believe in, that they worship Mother Earth, and the little animals and plants have far more rights than any human should have.
Well, let's go to Bob, who's calling from Tennessee, who has a question. Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Let me tell you a little quick story. This is nothing new. We're coming up on the 30th anniversary here in East Tennessee, and when PVA, which is Tennessee Valley Authority, which is a government-owned power agency here in East Tennessee, if you're not familiar with that, they confiscated thousands of acres in the two counties, Blount County and Monroe County, to build a lake. PVA had built a lot of lakes in this area for flood control. And up to that point, it was a pretty good thing. It was really necessary. Not only did they benefit from flood control, but they benefited from the power that the dam generated. This dam that they built 30 years ago, which took up all these farms, some of the best farmland in this part of the country, was not for flood control. It wasn't for electrical generation. It was for one thing and one thing only. It was for recreational use. And there were farmers there that owned hundreds of acres, that only 3 or 4 acres of the farm was taken in by the water, but they lost their whole farm. There was people taken out by federal marshals because they didn't leave their homes by the deadline. And we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of that. That was our own government that did that to those people.
Yeah, but sure is. And, of course, that was under our good old Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
No, sir, this was 30 years ago.
Well, 30 years ago. This was not then that TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, was it?
Yes, sir, it was.
Was it still?
This was 30 years ago.
All right.
On the 30th anniversary. And right now, TVA is selling that land, and those lots are going for up to $500,000 apiece. Those people were run off those farms. Some of those people offered to give TVA the land that the lake, the high water line was going to come up to, because it was only going to be 3 or 4 acres. The TVA would not allow them to do that. They took their whole farm, which some farms were, I know one in particular, it was 190 acres, and only 3 acres of it was going to be underwater. They offered to donate that to them. They said, no, we got to take your whole farm. That lady was taken out of her house by federal marshals.
Well, I think, of course, that's just totally uncalled for, and especially if they got to turn around and sell that property to private individuals.
Well, today that property is covered by golf courses and houses that run in start around $750,000 range up to $2 million, $3 million homes.
Well, I think it's, of course...
Lots are selling for, a lot, average lot on the lake down there in that area will cost you around $500,000. I guarantee you TVA didn't give anything near that for that property when they took it from those people.
Amen to that. Well, I share your concern, and I think we got to limit the power of government, and the federal government has no business doing something like that. And according to our Constitution, they have no right even owning property outside of the District of Columbia or for protection. But as government gradually expands its authority, of course, if they're going to do something, it should be done by the state or the local community, and then it should only be done, when it's going to be used for the public good, not for the public entertainment.
Well, the two county commissions concerned, I know, have brought it to their attention that property was taken at that time, and it was paid for by the taxpayers, and it should be used as parks and recreational areas and not turned over to private industry and private development companies. But that's exactly what's been happening.
Well, Arlene, would you have any comment at all for what Bob is saying?
Well, we have something similar going on in Santa Rosa with eminent domain, and eminent domain used to be just for public use of, like, building roads, but now, because of this Kelo decision, private land is now being taken to being sold to someone like a Walmart or something that would then be able to pay more taxes to the government. And so I understand every state is seeing more and more of this.
Well, of course, what we need to do is get state legislation that prevents them from doing that. That's really is the responsibility of our state legislature. And I was surprised that nobody up there, as liberal as they are, has not passed some legislation to protect property rights.
Well, Dr. Stan, we've got a state park here that joins the Smoky Mountains National Park, which is a federal park. Most visited park in the United States is Smoky Mountain National Park because it's on the East Coast. And we've got a park that joins that is federal land. It's called Cherokee National Forest. The only difference in the two is they allow recreation and hunting and fishing on Cherokee National Forest. Back a few months ago, President Bush designated so much federal property to be sold, and one of those areas was Cherokee National Forest. It's from the pressure from the developers. It's from in their lobbying group they're going to sell property that is paid for, has already been paid for by the taxpayers. That belongs to the taxpayers. Developers to use for their financial gain.
Well, of course, I'm sure they're very, very generous when it comes to campaign contributions. Thanks very much, Jeff. Bob, I appreciate your calling. Bye-bye. All right, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I think Bob's remarks are very well made, and I think he's absolutely right. I mean, where does the federal government get, usually what they do is they have these auctions, and most people don't get a chance to bid on them. I remember one of my friends, a doctor friend, I heard about this house that was going to be sold on the steps of the courthouse. And so he went down to the appointed time to bid on it, and nobody was there. And he went inside and said, "Where is the bidding?" And they said, "Oh, it was on the back steps of the county courthouse." And there was only one man there to bid for it, and he got it. Well, obviously, he actually went and said, "I'm going to go to the newspaper and let everybody know it." They said, no, you can buy it, you can buy it. That's the way they do things, and believe me, here in Santa Cruz, we're as corrupt as any other place.
Wow.
Well, what are we going to do as far as Santa Rosa is concerned? You're going to start circulating a petition on this. Then, Chris, that's a great educational opportunity to get people to understand what this is about. Are you getting any help from the local newspaper or television or the radio up there?
Well, the newspaper, for the most part, while those hearings were going on, was kind of silent. Finally, I think the third hearing, they had an article. And this last Sunday, on the front page, now that the hearings are all over, it has who rules the land. And they have the environmental position and the landowner position. Of course, we know who should be ruling their own property. But it was a fairly objective article. So at least we've made a little bit of news. But most people, unless their own land is affected, they just are not concerned. But we're trying to get them to be concerned, because one of the environmentalists at this last hearing said, you know, we just are not going far enough. Once we've done this in the rural area, we need to come into the cities. So it's not just the rural part they're going to keep control of. They would like to have control over everyone's house.
And they want, of course, to restrict our use of water and of electricity and of power. They want to restrict our access to traveling. They really want to get us out of our cars. You have to understand that is why they're running the price of oil up. There's no shortage of oil in the world. The Saudis say there's plenty of oil, so why is the price going up? How else are you going to get people out of their cars? We're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Well, Arlene, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Well, I so appreciate your allowing me to talk on this subject. I did want to tell you, I started to mention this part about the endangered species. This plan has three parts: the scenic resource issue, the biotic resource issue, and then there's an issue about timber harvesting and energy resource. So they, like you mentioned, they wanted us to get out of our cars because they're talking about global warming and making it appear that all of this is because of man's use of cars and greenhouse gas emissions. But the people that were so outraged were the ones that had these little circles drawn on maps of their land, and when they asked what that meant, it meant that there was some kind of an endangered species or wetlands, usually endangered species, and they would say, did you actually come on my property and you found these species? And the reply was, oh no, we just assumed that this was possible habitat for those species. So they went ahead and marked them anyway. And there was no justification for it, no validation. And that's just how these people are. They pull their statistics out of the sky. They truly believe that the ends justify the means, so whatever means they can use to get to their ends, that's perfectly fine. And we just have to wake up America to realize what is going on. We've had some of the attorneys that are working with us have told us, you know, this is really important, what's going on in Sonoma County. If you can stop it there, other people can learn from your example and maybe stop it in their county. So they say the eyes of the nation are upon us right now. So we've got a big responsibility. And we have a wonderful board. I'm so impressed with these women that are on the board. I only had known one or two before we met them when we had our first meeting. They're all dedicated, and we're going to really make a difference, I believe. So what we are planning on is a petition, and then if that doesn't work, we're going to have perhaps a recall. We are going to try, some are suggesting a class action lawsuit, and I really think it would be wonderful if we could have a statewide initiative so we could help everyone that's going to be in this situation when it comes to their county.
And of course, people have to realize that their property is in danger, man. Until people realize that it's going to affect them, most people are just going to shrug and say, oh, well, you know, that's somebody else's problem.
When I first started investigating this and writing about it, my husband was so concerned, and he spoke to my sister, and my sister said, well, I think she probably needs therapy. But then my sister and I found out that our property in Idaho had our water rights taken. So then my sister got involved, and we found out the water was being...
Stop right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Arlene was just saying that certainly her husband wasn't very concerned about all of this until he found that he was going to lose 3 acres of land. Her sister wasn't very concerned until she found that the farm that they have in Idaho, they lost their water rights. Did you lose your water rights?
Yes. It's a 500-acre area up in the high mountains near Kilgore that we had cattle on, and the water rights were taken for all of the ranchers up there. The streams were diverted, and the water was sent down to a wildlife refuge for ducks and geese. They had more rights than the ranchers.
And so I guess your sister suddenly began to realize that maybe there is a problem then.
Yes, and she decided I didn't need therapy anymore.
Well, of course, there's one woman that told me the other day. She said, you know, I listened to you for 6 months. She, little woman, listened to our big station up in Utica, New York, and she listens, of course, until 1 o'clock in the morning because the program there runs from 11 to 1. And she says, you know, she listened for 6 months before she finally decided I really wasn't crazy, I was right. Now she says, I try to tell people what's going on and everybody thinks I'm crazy.
That's right.
But that's all right. Our job is to tell people, and sooner or later they're going to realize we're right. Orlean, thank you so very much for being with us. God bless you. We'll look forward to having you on our afternoon program, and I hope many of our listeners out there will make it a point to want to come to hear the speeches by Michael Shaw and the others there as you're meeting on the 16th of September.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. We're looking forward to your coming. You're always an outstanding speaker, and we highly recommend you and invite anyone who can make it for the 16th to come and join us.
Good night. God bless you.
God bless you, too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan here, and I hope you've enjoyed our discussion with Orlean Cooley. If you've not yet read our Sustainable Development Syllabus, you need to get it. It's got the Earth Charter. It's got the a summary of the Global Biodiversity Assessment. It's got my talk on the planned population control or planned population control agenda monograph, the World Bank water policy, information on Marie Strong, information on the Georgia Guidestones, all sorts of great information that will help you better to understand what we're up against is an organized, coordinated effort by people who have a different worldview and they want to control your property, your life, your family, and you. So, again, the Sustainable Development Syllabus, the Sustainable Development 4-tape set, the Sustainable Development video, they're all available. If you get them together, why, it's with a reduced cost. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, the Sustainable Development Program is being pushed by the same people who are encouraging illegal immigration, by the same people who are intent upon getting us in war over in Iraq, by the same people who are really behind the World Population Control Program. They have many, many facets, but they have a common denominator, control over the lives of the people. We have a book that was actually written back in 1958. We've kept it in print for many years because it's probably one of the five most important books in my library called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. Goes into how the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and others are financing communism and socialism. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, they want to distribute your wealth, not their wealth, your wealth. They believe that socialism is a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory, but it doesn't work without force. Somebody's got to be in control, and they intend to be in control. That's Foundations, Their Power and Influence. You'd certainly want to get the book we carry that goes into the background of the occult forces behind the World Revolutionary Movement. And it's written by James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress. He tells you all about what's going on in Europe and tells you that the World Revolutionary Movement began with the French Revolution and, of course, continues to this day and brings it right up to the point where Fidel Castro comes to power. That's fire in the minds of men. We recommend it, but you need to see the video we put together called The World Revolution based upon that book. And we explain that we brought Fidel Castro to power. The center of the world revolution is not in Russia. It is not in China. It is right here in America with people of great wealth who are financing communism because they have a different dream. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
questions. There are many people asking why. There are many people paying attention. There are many now who see the big lie.
Afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation. It is Wednesday, the 23rd of August, 2006. Holy mackerel, things are getting ugly. I mean, things are ugly to begin with, but man, they're really getting nasty out there. And I think that folks are starting to recognize that very, very simple fact. So much so that they're starting to do television programs about it. Yeah, we are at the crossroads, and even the mainstream media is starting to recognize the simple fact that we are at the crossroads. But once again, there are those that don't want you to ask the question, where is the line in the sand? What do you do when it's crossed? Well, I think 250, 275 years ago, America knew what it was to do when the line was crossed, and they did it. And we ended up with our country. Question is, are we willing to do it again? This is Dave Von Kleist and Joyce Riley, and I'm going to be flying solo today. Joyce is up in Kansas City, and she will be calling in sometime, probably during this hour and during the next hour, to give us a report on what's going on with the big NAIS meeting up there. The No Animal Identification System folks are going to be